My name is Cease Cardigo from Prince Albert, Saskatchewan, Canada. I'm an alcoholic. How does a guy feel? 887 people asked me out of the door, is this the room that Chuck Chamberlain's speaking in? And I said, who's Chuck Chamberlain? But Marion fixed him. She got up here and she bellowed into this microphone, and they brought a note over, and they said, would you mind turning the mic down? We can't hear Chuck Chamberlain. And I didn't give the note to anybody. I sent it out in the crowd. So that's their problem. First of all, I'd like to tell you that my sponsor, Elmer, is speaking tonight at Dana, Saskatchewan, Canada. Now, you don't know where Dana, Saskatchewan, Canada is, and you don't know who Elmer is. But Elmer promised me that he would mention my name up there if I'd mention his down here. Let Chuck steal that one. I'm very grateful to be here. As I said, my name is Cease and I'm an alcoholic. I don't know why I started drinking. I don't know why I drank. I believe I do. But one thing I can tell you, I drank. I sobered up when I was 27 years of age, and I see a lot of young people at this conference. And I'm very grateful to see a lot of young people at this conference. If anybody tells you that you came too soon, don't you believe them. We came too late. I came from a very good home, and I came from a Christian home. Seems like one of the qualities. It was a poor home, but it was a good home. And I had a good upbringing. I was a good student. I was a good athlete. I was a pretty good boy. And I didn't drink. But on about 16 years of age, I decided that I didn't like the discipline of a home. I didn't like the discipline of a school. I didn't like the discipline of a church. And so I ran away from discipline. And I ran into the army. That shows you how smart I was. The first day I was in that army, I had my first drink. And I became exactly what I wanted to become. I became big. I became where I could talk to anybody. No matter what they were talking about, I knew more about it than they did. The only unfortunate thing is, the next morning, I was that same scared little fellow that ran away from discipline. I became an instructor in that army when I was only 16 years of age. I got kicked out of that army when I was only 17 years of age. I went back to my hometown and I worked in an aircraft factory. I made too much money and I drank too much booze. And I got too much responsibility, and once again I ran. And I didn't know at that time what I was running from, but today I know I was running from responsibility. I ran back into the army. I told them I'd never been in before, and this time I was a genius. I became an instructor. I got recommended for my commission when I was only 18 years of age. I got kicked out of the army again when I was only 18 years of age. And I didn't get my commission. But I was glad, and probably the rest of the Canadian Army were glad that I didn't get my commission. But it was a good conversational piece when I arrived back in my hometown. And I got another job. I got a job working for a newspaper, the advertising department. Once again, I got too much responsibility in that job, and I ran once again. And I ran into the Navy. I got recommended for my commission in the Navy. I went through officer's training. And I wish that I could stand here tonight and tell you that I was an officer in the Canadian Navy, but I wasn't. I got kicked out of officer's training. It seems that the officer couldn't do what I told him to do with the ship. When I looked out in the ocean today and saw those ships, I realized it's a physical impossibility. But I went as a gunner on a merchant ship, and I sailed all over the world, and I drank all over the world. I got married when I was in that Navy. I married a beautiful little gal from my hometown, and I wished I could tell you that I've led her a good life, but I didn't. Now, I've been asked to tell a story, and this is a story that nobody can steal from me, because it's my own story. I sailed in the South Pacific with many of the people from the United States. And while I was down in the South Pacific in Melbourne, Australia, as a matter of fact, some of you may have been there, one of your ships was torpedoed. And they salvaged it and pulled it back into Melbourne, Australia. And I'm only telling that story here because I'm not allowed to tell it in Canada anymore. I've told it so many times, and I'm glad that I'm down here. But they pulled this ship back in, and we were the only ship that didn't have any. We were the only empty ship in port, and they ordered us to go to New Guinea with your tanks. A bunch of Canadian tanks. We'd had a cargo liquor down to that country, and we stole a lot of liquor. We drank a lot of liquor, and they ordered us to go to New Guinea. We went up to New Guinea with your tanks, and I want you to be grateful for that because we did much to save your men. We got up there, and we had a little difficult time getting up there. It seems the Japanese people weren't too happy about us coming up there. And we were coming back out, and we were all drunk. Seems that you had to get drunk to get a little bit of nerve to go down the South Pacific. And on our way out, our own ship, our own aircraft came out from Melbourne, Australia to meet us. And we'd been bothered with a few Japanese ships. And our gunnery officer ordered us to open fire. And we started to shoot at our own ships, our own aircraft. And finally, the gunnery officer realized it was our own aircraft, and he got a little panicky. Now, I don't know what he got panicky for, because we couldn't hit him anyway. But he got panicky, and I want you to visualize just exactly what it was. I'm on a gun deck directly below the bridge in the forward gun deck. And the old captain, he took a megaphone and he screamed down at me. I'm in charge of this big forward gun. And he screamed down at me, "Cease fire!" And so I fired. And I don't know what you're laughing at. I got kicked out of the Canadian Navy and here I am. When the war was over, I went back to my hometown, and I started to celebrate the end of the war. And I celebrated the beginning of the Korean War, and I celebrated the end of that. I started to get jobs, and I started to lose jobs. And I didn't think there was, you mind closing the door, they can't hear me over there. And a lot of things happened to me. And I would like to say there were good things, but there were bad things. And I didn't think there was anything wrong with me. I thought everybody was doing what I was doing. But, am I interrupting something there? That fellow's trying to butt in. I'm going to start screaming like you did, Marion. I can do that, too. But I was 25 years of age, and I decided things were going bad for me, so I went in business for myself. I got a partner. I had a little bit of money. He had some experience. 4 months later, he had the money, and I had the experience. I'll never forget that day. I was 25 years of age. And that day, my wife took my two little girls, and she left my home. I went down to tell my partner what had happened, and he kicked me out of the business. And I went back to my hometown, and it's really getting to me. in my first AA meeting. I'm going to start yelling back. I went to my first AA meeting. I didn't go because somebody took me. I just went. I knew where the AA meeting was, and I come from a small town, and there was one meeting, and I went to it. And I'm always afraid of drunkalogs because that night, a lot of guys told a lot of drunkalogs. They'd been in jail. They'd been many, many places, and I hadn't been to the places where they'd been. And all I got out of that meeting was the fact that maybe I had about another 15 years to drink. Thank God I only lasted for another 2 years and about $10,000. And I came back. Last year that I drank, I became a fighter. That year I had 17 knockouts, and I lost them all. But I like to tell that story because that's what brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous. The last night that I had a fight, the last night that I drank, I got in a fight with a guy about as tall as Hal here, and he weighed 265 pounds, and he beat me real bad. And I hope I never forget that night because I was at a big party and my hometown was a stag, and I want you to know what they thought of me at that party. The last time he hit me, I stayed down on the cement floor, and they left me there. And I hope I never forget that. Because the next day, I went to hospital. And you know, some of us laugh about doctors. We criticize them. But I'll be ever grateful to a doctor that came and talked to me. And he said, Cease, I was in the army with you. You were a drunk at that time. I believe you were an alcoholic at that time. I've watched you since you came back to our hometown. And he said, you haven't got any better, you've got worse. And I said, well, what am I going to do? And he said, well, I can't do anything more for you. I've built you up physically. The only thing that I can do for you is give you some advice. And I said, what is it? And he said, oh, I'd suggest that you join Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank God he didn't leave it at that. He went out and he brought Alcoholics Anonymous to me. And he brought me two of the guys that I loved the rest of my life. One of them was the sloppiest drunk in all of Canada. But he brought him to me and he was sober. And he looked clean and he had a beautiful suit on. His hair was combed and he had a silk shirt and a bow tie and his shoes were shined. And he didn't have to say anything, he just had to stand there because I knew something had happened to him. The other guy that he brought was a man that I'd been in the army with. And this man had come out of the army, and he'd got sentenced to a penitentiary for robbery with violence. And he'd spent 5 years in the penitentiary, and he found Alcoholics Anonymous in a penitentiary, and he came to see me. And I'll be ever grateful for those two fellows because they came and they told me about this wonderful fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they took me out of that hospital. And I wish you could have seen me that morning because I hope I never forget what I looked like. I've always liked nice clothes and I've always had nice clothes. But that morning I had a shirt on with no buttons because they'd been ripped off me. But you see, my wife, who had come back to me because I promised her I'd stop drinking, and I didn't stop, I stopped for 3 weeks, she didn't come to see me in hospital because these two fellas told her not to. They said, let him suffer. And I'm glad they did. And I got out of that hospital, and I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had been there before, but I went to my first real meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was a Saturday night. And I hope I never forget it. Because I saw people like you people. I saw people smiling. And I didn't believe that they were all sober because it was a Saturday night. And I didn't believe that people stayed sober on a Saturday night. And they played foolish games like pin the tail on a donkey. They had a little social. And I really thought that some of them were half in the bag. As a matter of fact, I sniffed a few of them. After the social was over, they had a meeting. By 1 o'clock in the morning, two of the older timers, they sat me down and they said, Cease, There's no musts in Alcoholics Anonymous, but we're having a breakfast meeting at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning, and you must be there. And I was there. And I've never stopped going. That was January the 16th, 1952. Thanks to you people, I'm still here. I got many pats on the back. I was the youngest man in the group. I got many pats on the back. I broke my anonymity to people to get the pats on the back. Everybody said that you're doing a fine job, Cease. I got a real good job in my hometown. I started to get my self-respect back. I told everybody I was in Alcoholics Anonymous to get my self-respect back. And things were going pretty good. But after about a year, people stopped patting me on the back. People started to just take me for granted. And all of a sudden, I felt a void in my life. And I didn't know what to do, and I became scared. Thanks to a guy that attended two international conferences with me. I wished he was here tonight, but Ernie died a year and a half ago. He was in our group, and just about this time, he said, we asked him to be chairman. And he said, I'll be chairman if you'll do one thing with me. He said, I don't care who comes in to Alcoholics Anonymous. At that time, the Prime Minister of Canada lived in my town. And he said, I don't care if John Diefenbaker comes into Alcoholics Anonymous. We are not going back to the first step. We're going to start at the first step, and we're going to go through all of those steps. And not only are we going to go through, we're going to do them. And we wanted Ernie to be chairman, so we said, fine. And we started on those steps. And we took a look at that first wonderful step. We admitted we're powerless over alcohol, and their lives had become unmanageable. And I realized that I was powerless over alcohol, but I hadn't realized how unmanageable my life really was. But we started to study it in the book, the way it says. And I found out that I had a very unmanageable life, not only drunk, but I had an unmanageable life sober. I spent money like as if it was going out of style, and it didn't matter whose money it was. And I had a real unmanageable life after I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, doing the same thing. I can remember coming into Alcoholics Anonymous owing $6,200. At that time, there was a lot of money. And I can remember my good boss taking me to the bank and bailing me out and making me sign a paper that everything I bought in the future I'd pay cash for. And I can remember 2 years later, him taking me to the bank once again and having me sign the same paper because I was further in the hole than I'd been before. Because you see what I was trying to do, I was trying to buy back the love of my family by spending money foolishly on them, and I had a very unmanageable life. And we came to that wonderful second step, and it says, came to believe that a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity. I didn't mind that. The fact that I wanted to believe, I believed what they were doing, and I believed this. It was easy for me to believe in this power greater than myself. But when it came to this sanity bit, I thought, well, I've never been in a mental hospital, so how can I be restored to sanity? It's like coming back from somewhere you haven't been. But then I start thinking of some of the insane things that I had done because some of the people took me aside and told me. And I can remember once when I went to a neighboring city of Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, to apply for a big job. I always got big jobs. And I can remember going down there. I had an interview in one hotel. It was all set up for me. I went to another hotel. I got drunk. I stayed there for 3 days. I went back home. I didn't have the interview. My good little wife says, how'd you make out? I said, real good. Just waiting for a letter. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. You've told the odd lie yourself. But when you go to the mailbox every morning to see if that letter's there, I would suggest that maybe you are insane. And that's what I was. And then it said, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understand Him. And I don't know about you people, but I had a difficult time making a decision. And I can remember dear old Jack back in our group. Jack is a very sick man today, but I can remember one thing that he always said. He said he just couldn't make a decision. He said he stood at the end of a bridge one morning and he woke up drunk and he had this rope in his hand. And he said he couldn't decide whether he'd found a rope or lost a horse. And that's kind of funny, but I was the same way. I just couldn't make a decision. But then I can remember a guy in Alcoholics Anonymous by the name of Joe. And he came by and he said, "Cease, take it like this. You had an unmanageable life. In step one, in step two, you found a manager. In step three, just turn your will and your life over to the care of this manager. Call him what you want." And I did that. And then it came to that wonderful step four. And it said, "Take a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves." And I'd been a great guy to take everybody else's inventory, but I'd never taken my own. And I don't know whether there's anybody in the crowd tonight who haven't taken their inventory. And I'm talking about taking it the way it tells us to take it in the book, but writing it down. And a lot of people are going to say, "Well, that's not necessary." I don't care what you say. I say for me, it was necessary. And I had to write it down. I run a fairly successful business today. And if I was to go home and say to my staff, "Show me the inventory sheets," and they were to say, "We have so much of this and so much of that," I would say, "Where are the inventory sheets?" Because taking an inventory in the business of living, as far as I'm concerned, is more important to me than taking an inventory in my business. And so I had to write it down. And you know, a lot of people say it's not necessary. I can't find it in the book anywhere where it says it's not necessary. And I found out it was necessary for me. And if any of you are having a difficult time taking an inventory of yourself, I'm going to give you an easy little way to take it. Tonight, when you go back to your room, take out a pencil and a paper and figure out the person that you dislike most in this world. And start writing down what the heck you hate about them. And write it down with a real vengeance. Write down everything that you dislike about this person. And when you're all finished, put your name up top. And I guarantee you will have taken your own inventory. Because usually what we dislike in other people is what is really wrong with us. And I went to that beautiful step five. And it said, "Admit it to God, to ourselves, and to another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs." And you know, I had asked about step five. And you know what happened when I asked about step five? Some of the old timers used to say, "Don't worry about that. You know, easy does it." They damn near killed me. You know, the toughest thing about step five, as far as I'm concerned, is step four. Because I guarantee that anybody that takes a proper step four will want to take step five. Because you've already taken two-thirds of it. You've admitted to God and to yourself. And now all you have to do is go and wrap off to somebody else the exact nature of your wrongs. And then it comes to that beautiful step six. And it says we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. And we haven't really done anything, have we? We've just found out what's wrong with us. And we've gone and wrapped off to somebody else what's wrong with us. And then it tells us that we have to be entirely ready. And I can remember at the International Conference in Toronto 5 years ago, they asked me to talk on step six. And I wonder, well, why would they ask me to talk on step six? What can you possibly say about step six? And I went to the 12 by 12, and you know what it says? This is the step that separates the men from the boys. And I started to look at that step six, and believe me, it's something. Are we entirely ready to have God remove these defects of character? And in step seven, it told me, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. And I didn't know what to do because for me to be humble, the only way that I can be really humble is to get out of my knees. Somewhere along the line, somebody told me the definition of humility was the ability to stand and the willingness to kneel. And I was one of these people that told everybody to pray. I told them to pray driving their cars. I told them to pray riding in airplanes. I told them to pray walking down the street. I told them to pray in every every way possible, but I never ever told anybody to pray by getting down on their knees because I hadn't been down there myself. And I can remember when I was delegate to New York with some of you wonderful people back in 58 and 59. And I can remember dear old Shy Walker, who's now dead. And I can remember Shy telling us how he had to kick his boots under the bed to get down and pray. He kicked them under there by accident, and he thought one morning when he went to pick them up that he should say a few words. And he said a few words. And some of you might laugh about that, but I didn't have any high-top boots, but I'll tell you one thing, it works with shoes. And today I can humbly ask him to remove my shortcomings. And then in step 8 it told me to make another list. That's what it says. Made a list of all the people we've harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. And a lot of us say, well, we make a mental list. That's not what it says. It says made a list. It doesn't say anything about a mental list. It told me that I had to make a list. And I know the people I've harmed, and first of all, I've harmed me. And I harmed many, many people. And I was like Mary, and I left a pathway of heartaches and harm to a lot of people. And I made this list. And I wonder why, when our founders put these steps together, did they put them together just the way they put them together? I think that every one of us, whether we're in Alcoholics Anonymous, whether we're in Al-Anon, or whether we're in Al-Ateen, I think that every one of us is very self-centered people. I know I was, and most people that I meet are. And what these steps did to me when I started to take them one at a time in sequence, they started to whittle this self-centeredness off me, and it started to whittle me down to size. And this is what it did for me. And then it went on to this step 9. And it said, make direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. And I had no trouble paying back the $6,200 that I owed. I told you how I paid it back. And I don't think I deserve any credit for paying money back, because I don't know how they collect money in the United States, but back in Canada, when you owe money and you've got a job, they make sure you pay it back. So I don't think that I deserve any credit for paying my money back. But the amends that I had to make was go and apologize to people that I had hurt, that didn't know that I had hurt them. The people that I had assassinated their character, when I had to go up and say I was sorry. These are the people, the amends that I had to make that required me to whittle me down to size. And what does that really do to you? When you go and tell somebody you're sorry, it puts you down to where you should be. And it puts you in shape. And this is what step 9 did to me. Step 10 says, continue to take a personal inventory, and when we're wrong, promptly admit it. I wonder why they put step 10 exactly where it is. Bill tells us that it's a divinely guided program, and I believe that it is. And I believe about this time they knew, and God knew, that we might forget who we are and what we are and where we came from. And so they give us step 10 to take a look at ourselves each and every day. And I like talking about step 10 because step 10 is the step that brought me back to Alcoholics Anonymous after 10 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. For you see, after I'd been on this program for 10 years, I became very interested in material things. And I got many material things. But in my great struggle for material things, I became once again spiritually poor. And I forgot who I was and what I was and where I'd come from. Thank God I didn't drink. Thanks to you wonderful people, I didn't drink. I didn't stop going to meetings. I was still going to meetings. But I forgot who I was and what I was and where I'd come from. And I gave it lip service. I lost the good job that I had. I got fired. Thank God I got fired. And I like to tell this story because it means so much to me. At this time when I got fired, I have a little cousin back in Canada. She lives out at the West Coast. She too is a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she came, and I know that she just didn't come to Prince Albert at that time. I know she was sent to Prince Albert at that time. Because I know that she is the only person that could have talked to me. And she came, and she must have been a little confused because I'd written her the fall before. I told her how I'd turned down this big job, and she arrives in my hometown and I'm unemployed. And she talked to me, and she listened to me. And I can remember one day I was going to a conference about 600 miles away from where I lived. And I went down and I bought a brand new suit. And I went down to see this little cousin. And I stood up in front of her in my big egotistical way. And I said, "Well, kid, how do I look?" And Fern said just a few words. And I'm going to share them with you. She said, "You look real good on the outside, Cease. But how are you really on the inside?" And I went to this roundup. And I went with dear old Dave, who was now passed away. But I know that Dave was also sent there to take me to that roundup. Because he didn't talk to me. He let me drive the car. And he let me, because he knew something was happening to me. And he let me once again take a look at Cease. I went from that roundup into Winnipeg, Manitoba. I spent 2 days in a hotel, and I took a look at Cease. Thanks to Ross and to Tom and to another Tom who are in the audience tonight, they knew what was happening to me, and they stayed with me. And I remember Ross taking me to the train. And Ross probably didn't even know how much he did for me that night. But I know, too, that he was sent because he phoned me and asked to take me to the train. And I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'd never been away. But I came back and started doing the things that I was supposed to do. I once again got interested in institutional AA. I once again started doing the things that gave me a purpose in life. And it went to that beautiful step 11, and it says, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understand Him, praying only for the knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry it out. All of those wonderful words, but sometimes we just say them and we don't realize what they mean. The very fact that I can talk about prayer and meditation means a lot to me. The very fact that I can try to improve my conscious contact with God as I understand Him for me is a great thing. The fact that I can pray, and I can remember at Mount Eagle last fall when I was talking about prayer and Father Ed closed the meeting off so wonderful, and he told us how we should pray. And he told us that we should never pray at the expense of somebody else. And he told us that if we're playing football and we want to win the game, never mind praying about winning the game because somebody on the other team might be praying too that they're going to win the game. It's God's will for me the way it's supposed to be. And the power to carry it out. And I found that power through a God as I understand Him. And then that 12th step says, having had a spiritual awakening, as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, many people say to me, as I'm privileged to go around the country, how do you have a spiritual awakening? How do you get a spiritual awakening? It tells us in the book, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. That's how I got a spiritual awakening. A wonderful experience because it was only a personality change as far as I'm concerned. And you know, there's a little story that I like to tell. A story about a great actor that was asked to say the 23rd Psalm. And he went home and he rehearsed it the way many actors would do in front of a mirror on a tape recorder. And he did it because he was going to do the job he was asked to do. The Sunday before he was supposed to do this, he went to church and his minister said the 23rd Psalm. And the great night arrived and he got up in front of the microphone and he said the 23rd Psalm and there were thousands of people there. And he said it just beautiful. And when it was all over, he got a standing ovation. And he went back up to the microphone and he got the people to sit down and he said, there's a minister friend of mine in the crowd and I would like him to come up here and say the 23rd Psalm. And his minister friend came up and he said the 23rd Psalm the way it's supposed to be said, from the heart and not from the mouth. And when it was all over, there was no standing ovation. There was tears in many people's eyes. And the great actor went up once again to the microphone and he said, you see, the difference is that I knew the sheep, but he knows the shepherd. And I hope we leave this conference, the 35th International, and I hope we go back home and try to get to know the shepherd just a little better than we know the sheep. And then it says we tried to carry this message to the alcoholic that still suffers. I've said this many times. I perhaps had 1,012 step calls, and every one of them's been a success. Some of the people are dead. Some of the people are still drinking. Some of the people are in jails. Some of the people are in mental hospitals. Some have short terms of sobriety. Some have long terms of sobriety. But the reason that I say every one of those calls was a success is the fact that I am still sober. And that's the object of the exercise as far as I'm concerned. I tried to carry the message to the alcoholic that still suffers. And then it says to practice these principles in all our affairs. How many of us will leave this conference? Down south here you have all this lovely kissing and hugging. And how many of us will leave here and forget everything that we saw and we did down here? How many of us will go back to our jobs and be snarly with our fellow workers? How many will go back? How many of us will go back and walk down the street with a frown and a scowl and forget all the wonderful smiles that we've had here for a week? How many of us will go back to our homes and when somebody says something, we'll yell back, tell them to shut up, we're busy? That's not what it tells us in the book. It says practice these principles in all our affairs. What principles are they talking about? They're talking about those wonderful principles that we learned in those 12 steps, taking them one step at a time in sequence. Some of you are going to argue that you don't have to do it this way. I'm not going to argue with you. All I'm doing here tonight is to tell you how I did it. And believe me, it's been worth it. Now, I'm a pretty grateful boy in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've had many, many wonderful things happen to me. I have thousands of friends all over the world in Alcoholics Anonymous. I have my self-respect back through Alcoholics Anonymous. The store that I got fired from I now own, and I'm not saying that in a bragging way, I'm saying it in a very grateful way. I have a family. My wife is a member of Al-Anon. I have a little daughter that's not living at home anymore, and she was a member of Al-Ateen. And I have another daughter that's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, be ever grateful that I was around when she decided to join Alcoholics Anonymous, because she phoned me and she came to her first meeting with her dad. Now, I don't know whether that means anything to you people, because I tell that story because Marion said that she too had a family. And I'm sure that many of you have a family that are growing up in this cruel old world. And although they say this is not hereditary, I am sure that many of our children think and act and do the same things that we did. And I think they have a chance of becoming alcoholics. And I only hope that we will be around to make sure that Alcoholics Anonymous is still around for them. And we talk about unity this weekend, and it's so wonderful. And there's a little story that I like to tell about unity. And it's a story But a young couple who went out in a big wheat field, not in Texas, but back in Saskatchewan, they went out into this big wheat field and they lost their little boy. And they searched for their little boy for many hours and they couldn't find him. And they went back into town and they organized a search party. And they searched some more and they couldn't find him. They called the army in, and the next morning this army sergeant said, "Let's join hands and walk across this wheat field. And we can't miss him if we do this." And they did that. And they found the little boy. He was dead. And his father picked him up in his arms. And he said, "Why didn't we join hands before?" And I certainly hope that everybody will realize that this is what unity means, is by joining hands, each and every one of us, the way we are doing this weekend. And I'm going back to Prince Albert, Saskatchewan, Canada. Many of you people don't know where it is. Many of you people can't pronounce it. If you could pronounce it, you wouldn't know where it was anyway. We have good AA up there, and you've got good AA down here. No matter where you are, you have got good AA if you started on a personal level. And by starting it on a personal level, it starts to spread. And suddenly you belong to the best group in the whole wide world. And if every person is doing this, they too belong to the best group in the whole wide world, if we do it on a personal level. And I'm going back with a lot of gratitude in my heart. I'm going back with a full AA, pail of AA, very grateful to a bunch of wonderful people that have done so much for me. And there's a little town just outside of Omaha, Nebraska. As you drive up to this little town, you see a statue. Statue of two little boys. One little boy is carrying the other little boy. And you can tell by the way that he's stooped over, by the sweat on his brow, that he's having a very difficult time. But underneath there's simple words, something to this effect. "No, Lord, he is not heavy, for he is my brother." And I want to thank all of you wonderful people for being my brother. And I'd like to leave these words with you and hope they help you as much as they've helped me. You all look real good on the outside tonight. How are you really on the inside? Thank you, and God bless you.
Thank you, Cease.